Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Osiris. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
Hi, this is Dave Davies of the Kinks, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
DIY and How Studios presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, diggers. Welcome to another edition of Deeper Digs in Rock. Christian Swain here. I am the rock and roll archaeologist, and I'm buying the mic today home in San Francisco. All right. First off, if you haven't guessed, your humble host has a bit of a cold, and it's all in the throat. Luckily, you only need to hear me squeak through the intro and outro since I'm recording those today. Our interview was recorded a few weeks ago, so all good there. But enough about me. How are you? That's what I want to know. How's life out in Diggerland? Are you doing okay? Are you making it through winter all right? You know, spring is almost here, and I bet all of you cannot wait to see some good sunshine and green fields. I know even out in California here, we've had quite a bit of rain and dark skies, thunderstorms. So I cannot wait for spring myself. But seriously, this is the point. Drop us a line. You know, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's the RNRAP on Facebook. Yeah, that's an old one. And RNR Archaeology on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, I know. We are all Pantheon podcasts and all that. But we are still clearing boxes and moving furniture into the new home. So please be patient. Besides, you are original diggers. And we'll always be able to say to your friends in the future, yeah, I remember before the Pantheon podcast days. I want to make a quick shout out to our social media manager, Daryl Alber. He's been doing an amazing job for us in the last year or so. Funny, he started off as a digger and just wanted to be a part of our growing community. We're very lucky to have him. Okay, so you can always drop us a line there on the social media platforms, of which Daryl handles. Tell us what's up. Let us know what you're doing. Let us know what you like and don't like. Give us some insight. Ask us to dig deep into some subject you want to hear about. Let me tell you, we read all that you folks send. We may not get to it right away, but we do pay attention and try to incorporate as many of your ideas into our shows as possible. Remember, we are all about the entire history of rock and roll, or as I like to say to the intelligentsia, the entire history of music in the latter half of the 20th century, which I believe, and I bet a lot of you do too, is as important to art history as the Italian Renaissance. So think about all the important work you diggers are helping us to prove to the world at large and to future historians. It's a big fucking deal, and you are all a part of it. Let me say, you can always help us by adding a review on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, or wherever you are listening to this podcast. I cannot tell you how much of a big help that is for us, especially now that we have recently begun to pull shows like this one out of our big pipe where all the shows sit together, kind of like the online magazine or the podcasting magazine that we thought of, where our entire suite of rock and roll shows have been and out on their own. So like baby birds, we are slowly kicking them out of the nest, so we need our friends to provide a wee bit of assistance on the ground. So a good review on some of those shows that are now out on their own would be awesome if you could find the time to do that. So the big takeaway is we love to hear from you. And really, the reason I wanted to talk about this is we have recently received some very fine notes from some of you over the last few weeks. Some just telling us what a great job we are doing, some correcting a small bit of information or two, and some helpful hints as well. We all appreciate the conversation, the help, and the community. We're proud of what we've accomplished, and it seems you are all proud to be a part of it. So thank you very, very much. Okay, here's the news. We have a new show set to launch, and it's a good one. We are adding the most famous groupie in the world to Pantheon Podcasts. And let me say, as I've gotten to know this incredible woman, I can see why so many of the most famous names in rock and roll fell for her. She's bright and funny, sweet and charming, and she just carries a magical air about her. Wowza, it sounds like I'm already under a spell. And I bet you all will be too when we launch Miss Pamela's Pajama Party in the next week or so. Yes, that's Pamela DeBar is coming to Pantheon Podcasts with a new show that is all about Pamela. Just so you know, she is an accomplished writer and musician and actress. She's lived an extraordinary and adventurous life, and she is going to talk about it all. The show will be a bit of a free-for-all, or like I said to Miss P, no holds barred, and she corrected me and says, no holds debar. Yeah. So make sure you tune into Miss Pamela's Pajama Party coming up soon on Pantheon Podcasts. Okay, let me tell you about care of the personalized daily vitamin pack made with honest guidance and better ingredients. First, you can find them at takecareof.com. So I've been a vitamin junkie for decades, not a ridiculous amount or anything. I don't carry a suitcase full and get searched at airports or anything, but I do think they help protect my health in some ways. Call it insurance. It's just a part of my healthy routine and maybe should be of yours too. So I signed up with Care of a few weeks ago. It was ridiculously easy. I went through a quick online quiz that asked me a series of questions and then recommended a daily packet custom for my needs. Very easy and convenient. And boom, a few days later, I received a 30-day supply, individually packaged, that I open daily and take. It's so very easy and convenient. I love not having to go to the store to get my vitamins now. And here is a big thing for me. I'm allergic to dairy. More than lactose intolerance, I am lactose, please kill me with a fork if I eat cow's milk. And a lot of vitamins either include dairy in them or are processed in a facility that also processes dairy. Even that will literally kill me. Well, Care of takes allergies into consideration with the online quiz. So all my vitamins are non-poisonous to me. Isn't that awesome? I really, really appreciated that. So there are vegan and vegetarian options. And to me, that is a big difference with Care of. So do yourself a favor and go to takecareof.com and begin the survey to give yourself a healthy life. And we diggers get a special 50% off for your first month of personalized Care of vitamins by entering promo code DEEPER50. But you need to buy over $20 worth of vitamins. Keep that in mind. Finally, we are always one to promote a good cause, and a portion of every sale goes to Good Plus Foundation. Again, takecareof.com and promo code DEEPER50. Okay, diggers, that is quite a lot for me this week. So why don't we get to the show and meet our special guest?
Hey there, Tiny Me. Don't take your girlfriend's seat on New Year's Eve. The last boyfriend already took that. I didn't mean to make you laugh.
I really want to set this guy up because he is highly influential and yet undeservedly little known beyond the alt-rock crowd. Tyson Mead is a huge influence of 90s alternative rock and grunge. His first band, Defenestration, from the early 80s, had been cited by Kurt Cobain for helping to develop Nirvana's sound. And Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins has often said Tyson's second band, Chainsaw Kittens, as being one of his favorite 90s contemporaries. So he really is a seminal figure in the development of what became 90s alt-rock, and he continues to influence musicians even today. Well, he's got a new album set to be released on March 22nd. It's called Robbing the Nuclear Family, and let me tell you, it's a lot of fun. Tyson, who spent a few years in between all the rock and roll, teaching English in Shanghai, brings a couple of friends from that rock scene, PK-14 and violinist Hafiji, along with Matt Duckworth from The Flaming Lips and other guests, for a sly and witty good time. I really enjoyed listening to this album and hope you go out and spend some time with it when it drops. So, let's dive in to Tyson Mead. Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Tyson Mead. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Christian. How are you?
Oh,
I'm doing great.
Fantastic, fantastic. I'm really excited to talk to you. So my first question, on the new album, Robbing the Nuclear Family, the song Tiniest of Guys.
Yeah.
Who's Troy?
Troy, he sings on it as well. He sings at the end of the song with me, and he is this just... I love him, but there was a moment when things got a little strange. Yeah, and I would like to say that it's pretty much fully explained in The Tiniest of Guys. So
right.
Anything that I say in that is pretty much exactly what happened.
Well, there you
and
go.
I had to even edit it to make it, you know, PG instead of like triple X.
Oh, wow. So there's a triple X version that might come down the pike one day.
Might come. It's living in my head, but yeah, it may.
All right. So is there a theme to the album? This, I believe, is your third or fourth solo album. Is that right?
You know what? Even I forget. This is my fourth solo record.
Yeah, I think you had one in 96 while you were still with Chainsaw Kittens.
Yeah.
And then
you've
had three, I think, since like 2008, right?
Yeah. The first one, I had a soft release in 2000. I mean, not the first one, the second one, I had a soft release in like 2004 and then put it on iTunes in 2008. So, yeah. So the theme... and we'll probably get more into this. The theme of the album is, you know, for several years I lived abroad. I lived in China, and for the blink of the eye, I lived in Saudi Arabia until I had to leave under the darkness of night.
Really? There must be a story there.
Another triple X.
I knew about the Shanghai period, but I did not know about Saudi Arabia.
Well, there's another triple X story involved with that. So you can all fill in the blanks. But one of the themes of this album is, I guess, is finding home. And also maybe once you've found home, is home really what you thought it might be? Or does it live up to your expectations? And as always, I always get this wanderlust once I'm, you know, I've been stationary in the same place living. I bought a house like 5 years ago, and I've been in that house for, you know, 5 years. And
is that in Norman? Is that in Norman, Oklahoma?
My house is Right now, I'm house sitting in Norman, but my house is actually in Oklahoma City. I live across the street from Wayne Coyne, of all people.
From the Flaming Lips, right?
Oh, yeah, wow. Flaming Lips. Yeah. So that makes it a lot more interesting than it would be otherwise. But yeah, I get this wanderlust. Well,
I've been to a few Flaming Lips shows, so I can imagine what that must be like living next to Wayne.
Well, living across the street next door is like being at a 24-hour Flaming Lips show. It's pretty awesome.
I bet. All right. So, as a touring musician, once you kind of get into that lifestyle, it's a hard habit to break, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And once you've, once I tasted the fruit of Shanghai, I just loved Shanghai. I loved China. I loved the people. The people love America. I was so welcomed. And it was really hard for me to leave, but I felt like I was just marking time there, and I needed to, I had, as an artist, you have this drive inside to just, create. And I was not doing that. And I at the end of the day, my body of work is what is most important to me.
Right, right. So you left Shanghai 5 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, I 5 years ago. I'm horrible with timelines, but I think it was 5 years ago.
And then there was a fascinating project you were working on called Shaking Shanghai. Are you still working on that?
To some extent. It was, what I wanted to do was bridge the gap between Chinese and American music. And on this last album on Rubbing the Nuclear Family, there are some Chinese musicians from PK-14 and then an ex-student of mine who plays violin. And so I try to do what I can to bridge the gap, the cultural gap, and the it just seems like there's a void or whatever between us and China that the people who know how amazing the people are embrace it. But I want more people to know that. And that's one of my, was my sort of mission statement when I started making music again, really 5 years ago.
Yeah, because I think you actually just kind of chucked music away for a period of time, and you escaped to China to teach English. Just do that, right? That's where it started.
Yeah, that's where it started. And I thought that, as a young man, I'll make music. And then when I was really young, I thought, and someday I'll teach at a boarding school on the East Coast. And I didn't know that East Coast was like really East Coast, and it was actually not
8,000 miles.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. It must have been a very interesting time to be in China, because of their growth as an economic power and a cultural signifier of the modern 21st century. Because I think you left just after Chainsaw Kittens broke up. In 2002, right?
It took me actually, I moved there like 2000, around 2004, 2005. I don't really know, but I kind of kicked around New York for a while and was a DJ in Oklahoma for a while for The Spy and just did a few things until I lucked into a position teaching international students in New York at John Jay College and LaGuardia Community College. And from there, I got the opportunity to go to Shanghai and didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I just dove and just had basically no fear. I was like, I'm just going to do it. I bought a return ticket in case it didn't work out. But after I got there, I just loved it. And I was like adopted by several Chinese families as their brother or son and it was just an amazing experience that wouldn't have happened if the Chainsaw Kittens would have went into this, like, we had this trajectory where we were going to be as this platinum selling artist kind of in the vein of the Pumpkins, or Jane's Addiction or whatever. And that didn't happen, but it actually was the best thing that could have happened for my soul that it didn't happen. Because I got to go, I got to have this adventure. And it was sort of like fate doing me a favor, going, you know what? You're living so destructively, self-destructively as an artist when I was in the Kittens that you're not going to live. So the rug gets pulled out from under you and you have to figure out something else. And it was like the biggest favor the universe could have done for me.
Wow. It sounds awesome. And it also sounds like a lot of adventures in your life. You just kind of go for it. You, you know, there is no plan B and you just make it happen. So both Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins and Kurt Cobain of Nirvana cite you or your band's Defenestration and Chainsaw Kittens as huge influences on them. Which has earned you the title of the alt rock godfather. That's a big responsibility. I'm sure you didn't jump into music to achieve that. So let's get the long and winding road to how you got that moniker now. You are a Sooner native, right? And you grew up,
yeah, absolutely.
And you grew up in a house where music was really significant.
Yeah. I would say that. I had quite a few older brothers. I had three older brothers, an older sister, cousins. My dad, when I was really young, would play harmonica and I'd lay on his belly. That was how young I was. And he'd play harmonica and sing. And my sister was around 16, 17 when the Beatles, you know, were on Ed Sullivan. And so it was a perfect age. And so I see music as comfort, because she would come and get me in my, you know, not bassinet. I was 2 years old when that happened about. And she would kind of swaddle me and dance with me to She Loves You or I Want to Hold Your Hand or whatever. And I've had this realization not too long ago that music means security to me, I think, in this way. And then I had older brothers and cousins who listened to Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Alice Cooper and all this stuff that was their music. And then when I was like 11, I had to find my own. I had to find my own music, and I found Bowie and the New York Dolls and Iggy.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what was the first artist or band that you would call your own?
I would say Bowie and the New York Dolls and Iggy. I would say those three. And
That glam, that glam rock then. Period. You know, definitely, you know, Bowie, probably T-Rex is in there as well. You know, Pretty Things, you know, early 70s period. Alice Cooper is a great example too. American glam band that most people don't recognize as glam as they are, because they have that shock horror side of things.
And you know, in my Billion Dollar Babies art show, I made a Miss Pamela doll from the GTOs, because the GTOs were influential on Alice Cooper Group in their early.
Oh, they made their clothes.
Yeah, they made their clothes, and then on Facebook, Pamela DeBar, Miss Pamela, actually commented on the doll and was like, wow. You know, so I was like, I mean, this is the biggest like compliment to you, Pamela, because no one really knows the influence you had on that glam side of the Alice Cooper Group, you know.
Well, there's the connection between her and Frank Zappa, which of course is where Alice Cooper is first signed an act. And,
they're
nothing like the Alice Cooper band that most people know. This is it's a freak scene. They are the kings and queens of the freak scene at that time in L.A. And it's not until they move to Detroit and they start hanging around the MC5 and Iggy, that they harden their sound and they adopt this more horror circus. Which obviously did really well, and they sold a gazillion albums.
And they were able to harness the commerciality or whatever of their bizarre of what they were doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have a dog crawling. People, of course, won't be able to see this, but I have a small dog crawling all over me at the moment.
Oh, very nice, very nice. But dogs are welcome on the podcast. So you mentioned Bowie, obviously, and I could definitely can hear the Bowie and maybe even Brian Eno influences.
Yeah, Brian Eno absolutely is like my godfather.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I can definitely hear some of that, and that's nice to hear. It's you know, a lot of people don't recognize his contributions to music.
Yeah, and I feel like it. You know, if I can make an Eno album as brilliant as, like, Here Come the Warm Jets Taking Tiger Mountain or any of those pop records, those four pop records, I would be so happy because those are like my Bibles of, like, this is how a pop record should be made, you know, mm-hmm. a pop rock record. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely Eno. By a friend of mine calls some of my songs little Eno pocket symphonies, which I...
That's very nice. Apropos, yes.
Yeah.
So your first real band,
Defenestration.
Yeah. Hard to say sometimes. Defenestration. probably on purpose you did that.
So. Yeah.
So you guys moved to Norman, Oklahoma. And because that's a college town, right? You actually grew up in like a really rednecky sort of part of Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Bartlesville, which was like a rich oil town, like a small. Phillips 66 is, but it's got it's 30,000 people, so it's got the redneck element. It's got the wealth plus the redneck element, you know, and people in their attitude were way more redneck than, like, you know, urbane or whatever, you know. So
certainly,
so,
yes.
Yeah. So yeah. I got, you know, I got taunted and beat up and you know, called a
Because you're out and proud. You're out and proud.
Yeah.
I
didn't even know I was out. Right. You know, but I was. I was this little glam rocker, you know, walking around and with crazy hair and the craziest clothes that I could find. And yeah, and it just did not fit the mold at all of what this, you know, it was very uptight sort of town. I love it now. I got to say, I love it now.
You love going back and seeing it?
And seeing and like the woman who runs the Chamber of Commerce is a big Kittens fan. So it's really changed, you know. I mean, and I've obviously sort of become a, you know, the elder statesman of art of Oklahoma. So
isn't that just fantastic?
It's bizarre and it's fantastic and bizarre and wonderful. Yeah.
Right. So you moved to Norman with the band and a local high school friend to start the band, right?
Yeah. He was at the end of my tenure, as it were, in Bartlesville. I met all these skateboarders. They were exactly like me, even though they just thought the whole like status quo thing was stupid. And so it's like, oh, yeah, I guess it is, isn't it? And so we had this kind of gang of kids, of like 10 kids, that one of those skater kids started the band with me. He and actually his brother. And then his brother quit to work for Richard Linklater, the filmmaker, and
wow,
you know, was in like Slacker and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we had this sort of island of like music security or whatever that, he was going to school in Norman. And so I moved there.
Okay.
And then I thought, well, I'll go to school too. You know, so we were kind of this college band, even though we weren't really a, you know, what you would think of as, you know, we weren't like this REM kind of college band. We were definitely, you know, singing songs about drag queens and that sort of thing, you know.
Wow. So, and now I know with Chainsaw Kittens, you used to dress up in drag and really promote that sort of like a Hedwig and the Angry Inch sort of thing.
Yeah. You know?
But that wasn't the case with Defenestration, right?
No, not really. I mean, it was more like I was still kind of finding my way, and I was just, you know, and also that was when there were people like Motley Crue dressing up in kind of and Poison dressing up in kind of a drag thing. So we tried to do the opposite of what they were
testosterone
doing.
Testosterone-fueled drag thing,
this most bizarre, like, how does this even fit? You know, I mean, it was, you know, so like artificial. And so, it kind of like over time,
I don't know, some good symbolism for the 80s, it may be. So you saw in the music scene of the 80s, not a lot that you could identify with. Is that right?
Yeah. Like, Defenestration was definitely a reaction to what was going on, to like the Thompson Twins and the Howard Joneses and the Motley Crues and the, you know, and what U2 became once they put out like, well, once they put out like War and then Unforgettable Fire and you know, and then Sting sort of like became this easy listening thing. And so all the music that we had kind of attached ourselves
to. The dream of the Blue Turtle, right?
Yeah. And I'd been like a Police fan. Yeah. I'd been like a U2 fan early on. And then I saw how they became this, and even the Pretenders became this other thing. And it's like, well, we just want to rock. That was our thing, is we wanted to rock, but we wanted to have, you know, I wanted to write like words that meant something too. Like, and it was definitely a reaction against, like the Howard Joneses break off those mental chains and that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you guys only lasted a few years, I think, like a couple of albums, right?
Yeah, we had a couple of albums, and you know, it's one of those things, we were so young, and Todd and I started writing when we were both teenagers, and by the time we had any, you know, we had our first album, I think I was 22, and then, you know, it was 24 when the next album, the second album, came out, so it almost took so long, or we felt like in our, you know, in our teenage, early 20s,
right.
In our youth brains, this is taking forever. And you know, we had a core group that after Todd's, my writing partner, after his brother left, we got the drummer's brother, who was a freshman in college, and he was just brilliant, Chris Royce. And the drummer, Paige Royce, it was Paige Royce, Chris Royce, and Todd and I, and then Paige quit before we even did our first record. So it's kind of over before it even began with Defenestration.
So too many personnel changes. You couldn't get a core that was magical and keep continuing the process that would normally lead to success.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like you have a band, for better or worse, like U2, who found like had their core and it always stayed that way.
Yeah, even today,
you know, and I feel that way about like the Alice Cooper group too, because it was that the Alice Cooper group, they were friends from high school in Arizona.
Oh yeah,
and they went all the way to, I guess, Muscle of Love together, and then Alice became what he became, which. You know, I can understand why he did it, but it just, you know, the Alice Cooper group is like just the power, you know.
I mean, it really is. It's a lot of people need to go back and rediscover just how important they are. If they know a little of the history, you're really amazed this is a group of guys that should never have been at the top of the pop charts, and yet they were.
I mean, it was like they just scrambled their way through shock, horror, and awesome rock and roll, mm-hmm. into the, I mean, by well, the time Billion Dollar, yeah.
They gained their 10,000 proverbial hours just like the Beatles did in Tucson.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, by playing the club circuit there and opening for, you know, these great bands over the years.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely, and even when they did Pretty's For You and Easy Action, you would think, oh my God, this band is going nowhere. They're going to be as about as popular as Elephant's Memory, you know. and then, you know, Shep, I mean, I guess actually Bob Ezrin.
Yeah.
You know, because I guess they already had Shep Gordon, but
yeah.
Then Shep Gordon knew exactly what to do to get them, you know, and it was just magical.
Really. Well, it was Detroit. It was Detroit.
And it was, yeah, Detroit.
And hardening that sound, seeing the MC5 and Iggy and the Boys.
Yeah,
and,
exactly. That, exactly. So, and yeah. Knowing where to go with it, where,
right.
You know, there were other shock bands like Blood Drop that just didn't ever, you know, go past,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So a little bit more like what happened to Defenestration. So then you and Todd Walker split. Then it really became obvious that that was not going to continue.
That it was like once we split, I realized I'd gotten to the point where I could write songs on my own and didn't necessarily need a writing partner. And so I had enough songs when my buddy Trent linked me with the guys and the Kittens, who were actually all in high school. I was 25. And they were all seniors in high school. He's like, Trent had been a fan of Defenestration, and I didn't really know what to do. And he's like, you know what? You need to play. They're about to kick their singer out. You need to play your songs for these friends of mine. They know who they are. And so it was like
and
sort of.
And I think
of
they
a,
knew who you were. I think they were fans of Defenestration as well.
Yeah,
right?
they'd been fans of Defenestration, and I knew kind of the workings of the industry, even though it hadn't like gone to the point of, you know, it's still like alternative, like still like indie underground, you know, like to get a record deal for like $5,000 was amazing, you know.
right.
And so it was like a weird thing because there was a contradiction of, you know, it's kind of like tucking my tail between my legs and going, okay, I'm going to play with these high school kids. But then also once we had one rehearsal, I was like,
oh, they're good. They were good. Huh?
They're good.
Yeah.
They're really good. And having these like cute 16, 17 year olds and me, and I was fairly young, you know, looking and stuff. And so we made a demo January of 89, started talking to Mammoth Records we formed in 89, January, made a demo in February, was talking to Mammoth Records like by March. So within 3 months, we were already, you know, talking and
ready to sign.
Right. And so, so it happened really fast and they were really excited. And, you know, that was sort of how the Kittens were born. And then a year later, Trent, who hadn't been in the band, joined. And as things do, there was a lot of changes in the band. But I always tried to make it like, okay, anytime anyone leaves, we've got to, you know, just figure out. Because it was a different thing than Defenestration. It wasn't like me and my buddies. It was like me and these guys that I didn't really know.
You were definitely the leader. There was no question about it at that point.
And they were
supporting your vision of what you wanted to present to an audience in the early 90s, where music is beginning to shift. I mean, you know, we talked a little
really
bit about
shifting.
the wasteland of certainly the later 80s that might have existed musically out there. By the time you get to 89, 90, you start to see the cracks forming, and obviously Nirvana, you know, just smashes everything to pieces.
And
now there's opportunity for somebody with a more unique vision, a rawer sound like you guys presented, right?
Exactly. And you know, and we came along, then Jane's Addiction came along, and then Nirvana, you know, and like with Defenestration, at least, you know, we were kind of first of that sort of thing was like.
Well, as we discussed at the beginning, you know, somebody from just outside of Seattle was buying those Defenestration albums as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, and it was like Defenestration. The thing is, we didn't last long, but we actually made. Yeah. Yeah. So it was. And it's very nice, you know, as an older person.
Chainsaw Kittens is not too dissimilar either. Proven very influential without a whole lot of financial success. I saw a quote while researching, and I want to get your response from it. So here's the quote. Arguably the best American band who never made it in the heyday of 90s alternative rock. How does that make you feel?
It's heartwarming because there's a quote that that I read from Patti Smith like years ago when I was a kid.
Another big hero of yours.
Yeah, big hero. And she basically at one point said, I just did this to communicate, to write, like writing a letter to people. And that's, I was like, oh, that's a really great way to look at what you're doing. And my music has always been like a letter to people. And I never really knew if it would be some thing that would be a hit or if it would
a commercial success.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Like a commercial success, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really set out where I know that, you know, there are bands around me, they set out to, you know, sell platinum records. And I didn't even think, you know, because I think of like Patti Smith Horses and it's highly acclaimed, but when it came out, it didn't sell a whole lot of records. It was just, you know, it's just this awesome record that the few people who knew about it, you know?
Yeah. 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 And it's gone on to, like your records have gone on to influence the next generation or the generation after that in their music.
Yeah. And I hope so. I mean, I hope that I have some sort of influence and that I stay relevant. And I also have the like luxury of when I make an album, knowing that I don't have the pressure of like, oh, my gosh, a million people have to like,
there's no thought of that in your musical process.
Exactly. And that's where I felt like, you know, feel
there's freedom.
There's
freedom.
There's so much freedom. Yeah. And I feel like that's where I get to be Brian, you know, because he gets freedom to do what he wants because his audience are the type that are going to listen and not like abandon him if he does something that he didn't do before, which is what I use as kind of my model of how I do what I do too, you know? Mm-hmm. And also Scott Walker is a big like influence of he can just do whatever and people are going to be like, oh, I love that. Or I don't love it, but it's still Scott Walker and I'm sticking by, you know?
Well, there's been several bands or artists over the age of rock and roll. The first being the Velvet Underground. Who Brian Eno, famously said, you know, maybe 30,000 people bought that album, but every one of them went out and started a band.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So there is something to be said about, the rock that we build on and the work that you've done seems to be more on that side as opposed to the dollar signs.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never really thought about money, which is, you know, a little detrimental to my bank account. But at the same time, I have the freedom and I can, and if I wanted to just like tomorrow, just go like to whatever Egypt and just live for a few years, I could, you know, I wouldn't. And speaking of the Velvet Underground, like my hero from the Velvet Underground, I love John Cale, but Nico from the, you know, obviously on the first album.
Right.
Like the way she lived her life without the heroin per se, but the way she lived her life and that she made these albums that were so out there, but they're also part of my, like the Marble Index and Desert Shore are two albums that I look at and I go, yeah, that's the sort of, I would like to, I don't know if I'm ever that daring, but I at least want to try to be that daring.
Right. And you've always been that way. This is not something that you now look back on and say, oh, geez, you know, I didn't make a lot of money, but I did all these other things. You were cognizant of this at the time that you were,
yeah.
you were actually going through this, which, you know, could cause a lot of people a lot of heartache and trauma, you know, but that's not how you took it.
No. I never just feel really fortunate to be able to do what I do and, you know, not necessarily have to have like a day job or a job where I'm doing something I really dislike, you know, and it's been nice to have that. I mean, I don't have lots of money and I'm always kind of scraping and hustling for money.
But you're an artist. You need to constantly produce. So it causes to constantly produce. Yeah,
exactly. And that's pretty wonderful because I have a friend who's he's quite a bit younger. He's a millennial. He's 32. He's just the sweetest guy. And he's like, you can't let your brain crystallize. And you're not letting your brain crystallize. And that's how I feel like, okay, I just got to keep pushing and pushing, you know, my artistic boundaries and go as far as I can. And fortunately, the people who love my music are always ready to go wherever I'm going.
I can see that
with my records.
Yeah.
That's, I feel really fortunate about that, you know?
Yeah. The new record is very rich. There's a lot to be loved about it. A lot of different and diverse musical ideas are going on. And we'll get into that a little bit. I want to continue on here. So with Chainsaw Kittens, there were five albums that you guys did that our diggers, our fans, we call them the diggers, should go out and get. So is there a favorite one you might suggest or an introduction to Chainsaw Kittens?
Oh my gosh. They're like my children. I'll give you a, you know, it'd be just hard to like, the first one, Violent Religion, is sort of my mental breakdown I was having a mental breakdown when Defenestration was breaking up. So it's definitely captures that sort of
darkness,
but there's some real just great rock and roll on it too. And then the next one, Flipped Out in Singapore, Billy Corgan heard Violent Religion when they were doing Gish, and he played it for Butch Vig, and he said,
These guys are awesome, right?
These guys are awesome.
And you need to you need to work with them.
Right. You need, yeah. So Butch Vig, when right after he had done Nevermind, he produced Flipped Out in Singapore. So it's like a great rock and roll record. If somebody wants to just, if you just want to go out and hear a great rock and roll record, that's like the, I just love it because it's balls to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Angel on the Range, which was like a 7-song record that I love it too. It's sort of, we had new members. We had new members on each of those records up until Angel on the Range. And that's when we got, Trent was solidified. He had been in on the other records, but he was like my writing partner, and we had Matt Johnson playing bass and Eric Harmon playing drums, and they would continue from then on out. And Eric, we lost a year ago, and he's still my favorite drummer in the world. And so when Pop Eris came out, just, I would say Pop Eris, a lot of people say that's our masterpiece. We signed to Atlantic Records, and they, things were going to go through the ceiling, and they didn't. And so then we had the self-titled after that, that the Darcy and James from the Pumpkins started.
Yeah, when you signed with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they put that out, and that's more like, you know, that's more of a pop. It's not as rockin' as the other records, but a lot of people love it. And then the All-American Chainsaw Kittens, which was our last record, which was, we did it a lot like we did our first record, just like a short amount of time. And I really think it's good too. But I don't know, Pop Eras might be the one to start with. I don't know. But yeah, it's hard to say, you know.
Well, we just want to start them on, you know, a trail, and we'll start with the Pop Eras and then let them go from there for them, for each one of them.
Yeah, yeah, that exactly, exactly.
But great, great, great explanation for each one of them. And definitely it's like the family, you know, there was the baby and the oldest one.
Yeah,
and,
without a doubt. And exactly. And I like to see how they all, you know, where they all live sort of in people's minds, because it is like a child where people have their favorite, and I'm like, well, yeah, that's my favorite. And then somebody else is like, oh, this is my favorite. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's my favorite too. Yeah.
Right. Oh, just like a proud parent, of course.
Yeah, very of much course. Like a of proud course. Parent, yes.
So since the end of Chainsaw Kittens, you've released two solo albums, not counting the upcoming Robbing the Nuclear Family.
Yeah,
2008's Kittens and Bathrooms, and 2004.
Kittens and Bathrooms,
I'm sorry. Kittens and Bathrooms.
Yeah.
And 2014, like Kittens and Bathrooms. Kittens and Bathrooms. And 2014's Tomorrow in Progress, with some interesting titles like Nihilists Need Love Too. I love that song. That's just so awesome. And 2014's, Buddy Dash, Twisted, Cognac Leeches. So I want to ask you about your songwriting technique and the subjects you choose, because they are so different. You know, how do you go about getting inspired?
Oh, wow. Let's take Nihilists Need Love Too. I was reading about Nietzsche, and I was getting, you know, I'd already got kicked out of Saudi Arabia, so I went back to China. I was about to get kicked out of China, and all these weird sort of nihilistic things seemed to be happening where I just felt like I was kind of losing my mind, but then I was also really paranoid. And so I filtered it into that song. I had read that Nietzsche, you know, like had a breakdown and was kicking a horse. And then I thought, well, you know, what sort of pornography is Nietzsche into? And I'm like, oh, he would be totally into like Antichrist porn. And so
right.
So that was sort of I do the cut up method that, you know, that Burroughs, you know, and
Bowie did for a bit.
And Bowie, yeah, exactly. And I guess Geisen was maybe the one who started. I don't know who started it, but but I kind of do that method, but I don't actually physically cut anything up. I just
play around with it in your brain.
Yeah, in my brain. Okay. And so I think of like the Brian Eno titles like Papa Negro Blowtorch and you know, and Blank Frank and Dead Finks Don't Talk. And I put my titles up to myself where I'm like, is this a Dead Finks Don't Talk kind of title? And I'm like, okay, yeah, Nihilists Need Love Too is definitely kind of a Dead Finks Don't Talk kind of title, you know?
Very interesting. Since 2014's Tomorrow in Progress, you've kind of been quiet. You've been busy writing the new album? Is that where you've been? Your head's been?
Yeah, you know, I've been working on the new record. I also have been painting a whole lot and selling my paintings. The other huge influence on me, more in the fine arts way, is Captain Beefheart, Don Van Vliet.
Oh, yeah.
And I love how he, at one point in his life, he just really started painting. And so I've, you know, been painting and selling my paintings. And so that's how I've been living. And I just love doing these huge abstract paintings. And then I just did a show at this, I call it a Reefer Warehouse, but it's a dispensary in Norman, And I just did my $1 billion babies, Barbies art show there, which is sort of, you know, like I was saying, a play on $1 billion babies. And I, one of the pieces in that, I, you know, I do my painting, but I also, I put together this huge oversized wallet that I see as Glenn Buxton's wallet,
Alice Cooper.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Cooper, who mm-hmm. went and hunted to Never Never Land. It's his and wallet.
He passed away.
Yeah. And just such, he's like, you know, I guess everybody in the Alice Cooper group is my favorite, but I just love
there
so much.
There was something
about
original
him.
About Glenn's guitar playing.
And just his persona. And yeah, exactly. And so this wallet is as imagined by Pat Boone. And so, so that was a lot of fun to make this big oversized wallet. That's it's like, 26 inches by like 14 inches. So it's the size of like a couple, like a double record basically, but I've made it into a wallet and it has, you know, like West Side Story sheet music coming out of it because of the School's Out. They did Sharks versus Jets or whatever. And that it has there's actually a nude picture of Pat Boone from Time Life that's in it.
Really? There's a nude picture of Pat Boone
from the 50s. Yeah, exactly. They used to do that in like the 50s and like, you know, take these. And they'd be in Time Life, which is so, in Life magazine, which is so bizarre to think. And, and it's big enough for the $1 billion from the $1 billion Babies record to be in it as well. So it kind of fits the $1 billion. Yeah. So anyone who knows that record will, or knows the Alice Cooper group up to $1 billion Babies will absolutely love the exhibit because there's a lot of kind of inside jokes. But so that's another thing that I've been spending my time doing.
So Robbing the Nuclear Family, when does it drop? Is it March?
It comes out in March. I'm not sure the exact date, but yeah, it comes out in March.
Mm-hmm.
And
we'll be sure to find out and tell our diggers here when that comes out. So
for sure.
So what about the writing process with that album? As we mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, you've had some of your friends from Shanghai on the album. How did you go through the process, or what was different about it compared to your last few albums?
Well, you know, this album, I started on Tomorrow in Progress, started doing this, but with this album, I really, for the most part, there's a couple of songs written on guitar, which was always my instrument. But this time I really did the Brian Eno thing where I just started songs like P.S. Nuclear Forest Boogie and Grandsons, and especially Motorcycle Boy Number 3. I started them as soundscapes, and then I made them into songs where they didn't really have any sort of concrete structure until I added words. Mm-hmm. And then I would, And so it was a new way of doing it for me that I kind of delved into the last album, but really embraced this album where I'm just, you know, I thought, oh, I really want to try this, just doing soundscapes where it's not guitar based, because I'd always written everything as like a guitar-based song, and then I'd put additional instruments. But this album, for the most part, I didn't do that way, you know?
Yeah, you created these soundscapes with various instrumentation and sound that you then wrote the lyrics afterwards to fit within what was presented to you from the musical palette. Okay. All right. Very interesting. Yeah. And I think, let's see, I think it's 10 songs are on it here. And you've, and you've already made a video for one of them, right?
Yeah. There was actually a video for P.S.
Nuclear Forest Dance Boogie.
Yeah, exactly. And there's actually a video for He's the Candy as well that will surface later, I think, too.
Oh.
And we are, I think I'm going to make another video too by the time it's out.
Oh, great. And let's see, the record company that this is on is
The vinyl came out on Jet Plastic.
Jet Plastic, right.
That's yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's out right. of Detroit, okay. yeah.
yeah. Yeah, very interesting. So are you going to tour this this album?
I'm trying to figure that out. I want to make it, whatever I do, I want to make it really interesting. So if I can do a tour where I want it to be like a little more theatrical and a little more, you know, I'm also kind of going, okay, what would Brian Eno do if he went on tour? Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. so I want to make it where it really is a different sort of experience than people usually have at shows.
Are you in the process of putting that together right now?
In my head, I am. I'm such a procrastinator as well. So yes, I am. I think.
Uh-huh. Have you attached musicians to a touring band?
I have some people that I might use, and I'm trying to think of how I can do it as just a one-man band as well. Uh-huh. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure all that out right now too.
All right.
So it'll fail miserably or it'll be really cool. What are the other right things?
Yeah. Well, let's hope that it's really awesome. I think everybody'd love to see you out there. You're known as quite a charismatic and dynamic front man. And we'd like to see you treading the boards here.
Yeah, I would like to too. I mean, I feel like I still, you know, I just love the, you know, the energy of the live setting and I love meeting people. Like, it's always nice to meet people that have followed my trajectory or whatever, and so I look forward to doing it, and I just have to figure out how to do it.
So something else that I found interesting while doing some research on you is that you ran for the 5th Congressional District seat in Oklahoma last year.
Yeah,
I didn't know you were a politician.
I wasn't, and there was so much going on that I felt like there was a teacher walkout, and our governor was just like so just reprehensible when it came to attitude toward the teachers that, you know, we have the worst pay scale in the United States, mm-hmm. or at least, mm-hmm. you know, at the bottom. And the governor, Mary Fallon, was saying that they just were like spoiled kids who want a new car. They don't deserve a living wage. And so that was the thing that prompted me. When I threw my hat in the ring, I didn't even really realize what I was running for. And I was like one of the last people to like announce my candidacy. But it was another situation where I did something so out of my comfort zone. I actually became friends with the woman, Kendra Horn.
Who won. Yeah.
Who won.
Yeah.
And who upset Steve Russell.
Steve Russell,
yeah.
Which was a Republican. Kendra is a Democrat. And that's
yes.
the first time a Democrat has held that seat in 45 years.
And she and I became friends. And it was really funny because there was a situation that made the Fox News site one of the other candidates had stolen her signs or had, you know, pulled her signs up from like I guess it was a public space where they weren't supposed to be, but it's kind of not a good thing to do. And he got caught. Mm-hmm. And,
I remember seeing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and it happened right after, and all of this is such great fodder for Fox News because it happened right after the Pride Parade. Mm-hmm. And so I saw her at the Pride Parade before all this happened, and I hugged her and I was like, oh, you know, I wish we could both win, but you know, you're my friend. And she's like, oh, I love your, you know, campaign video where you say a vote for meat is a vote for weed. I was like, I know. And I was like, I can't believe that, you know, Tom, the other candidate, did this. And so it made it on the Fox website. And it was like, oh, these bleeding hearts who love each other, you know, the candidates who are supposed to be opponents, they're like actually hugging each other. What is this world coming to, you know?
Jeez, that's crazy. But, you know, that, what do you expect from that news channel? Or,
exactly.
Me, Faw News Channel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So what is next for Tyson Mead?
Oh, what is next? You know, the album coming out
in March.
In March. I'm actually working on a couple of books. I've almost got the rough draft written for, because I feel like people want to know about, at least I need to tell, it's basically a memoir from when I was 13, after I kind of discovered all the music that I was discovering, but like my first real friend who told me I could sing, and so I'm working on that right now.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it's called Swashbuckler. So, I'm excited.
How you see yourself, as a swashbuckler?
Well, it was sort of like when I was a kid and I was, you know, sort of the outsider. That's how I saw myself as like a 13-year-old, you know?
Yeah. 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 Very cool. Very cool.
So,
all right. So there's the painting, obviously.
The painting, yeah.
The new album that's coming out, a book that you're almost finished with, and hopefully a tour.
And hopefully a tour, and then launching my own brand of weed.
Oh, yes. Is marijuana legal in Oklahoma yet?
It's medical, but it's like, if you say the magic words, you get a medical card. So it basically, I mean, people are toking up everywhere here. It's like, you know, okay, wait until I stop smoking. Or stop smoking all the time, anyway. Wait until I stop smoking to make it, like, basically legal. So, yeah, it's, like, on paper not legal, but it actually is legal, you know.
Well, you know, we out in California, we had to go through that process ourselves. Over a decade, and now it's completely legal.
There are
30 states that are well on their way. It should be federally legal here in the not too distant future.
I know I'm preaching to the choir, but it's just ridiculous that it's not legal. And but it's so cool to see this change of attitude, like the people, you know, my friends who are like in their 70s who would have always been sort of like, oh, marijuana, isn't that, you know, the devil's weed? Now it's like, oh, yeah, you should totally launch your own brand, you know?
Right. Again, not too dissimilar from the gay marriage issue that we had to deal with not too long ago. And now, of course, everybody's like, yeah, whatever, that's no big deal.
Even though
the previous 30 years was literally a culture war.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what is the name of the weed?
It's going to be Mead Weed.
Of course it is. Mead Weed.
Yeah, right, Mead Weed.
Right. Well, before I let you go, I want to ask you one serious question I present to a lot of the artists that we talk to here on Deeper Digs and Rock, and that is the state of music today. You know, what do you see out there, or what do you see the future might be in you know, from your perspective?
Oh, wow. You know, I know that there's a lot of people really interested in, you know, in the, like, the grunge, whatever, alternative era. Like, it's almost that the way that I would look at, like, Hendrix or Zeppelin or that sort of thing.
That common 20-year rearview mirror where the next generation is just kind of coming into their own and looking back to their youth, what was exciting and interesting or, you know, just above them. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm answering a lot of questions, and I'm also, you know, I'm actually going to, the other book I'm working on, there's going to be two, is basically the oral history of, that would be sort of a Please Kill Me type of book. This, you know, from alternative, from like 82 to when Cobain died. But I really feel like that music is going to keep sort of influencing what is to come. But I also feel like I'm like, there's so much that is really interesting, like with electronica and different things. And I feel like bands like Radiohead are, even though, you know, they've been around over 20 years, 25 years, I guess. I feel like bands like that have a trajectory of pushing music forward too, even though most of the time it's not what people are expecting. But so I don't know. I just feel like it's always sort of an ebb and flow with music. And I feel like I don't know if the album will ever be as like important as it was if it's just going to be songless now, which is, for me, that's kind of a shame. But you ask a 15-year-old, and that's just how they listen to music.
Singles, which was the case, you know, prior to the Beatles, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
it was all singles.
It was all singles.
Yeah, we've just gone full circle again, which is common. So, but it is a bit of a shame that, you know, a body of work released all at the same time to be taken as a whole and digested that way is not really the art form in music today, but it's the way it is.
It's the way it is. But I feel like, you know, with people like me who are doing it where it's like robbing the nuclear family really is to me a concept album in a lot of ways, because it has a beginning and an ending, and then it has the, you know, what happens in the middle. And I know you could listen to it as like singles or whatever, but it really is meant to be listened as an entire piece, you know.
Well, you heard it here first, Diggers. Go and get the new album, Robbing the Nuclear Family, and listen to it as a concept album. So, hey, Tyson, you know, I had a famous producer tell me that, you know, if you really want to make it in the music business, find out who your heroes are. And I think we did a lot of that today.
I really
appreciate that, and I really enjoyed getting to know you on our time here. So thanks so much for being with us today on Deeper Digs in Rock.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you so much. It was fun. I really enjoyed it.
Give it up to Tyson Mead. What a very interesting and fun time we had. I really enjoyed the hell out of talking with him and learning his story and influence on so much great 90s rock and roll. I hope you did as well. When you look at the entire history of rock and roll, it's fairly easy to pick out the beginning somewhere in 1955 or 56 as the Big Bang. It's when the emerging elements of artists developing a new sound along with technology to create and spread it, as well as the new burgeoning and hungry audience, all arrive at the same time. You know, the rest of the story is like the universe, expanding wider and further until it cools and collapses. Now, the beginning we talk a lot about in our first two episodes of the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcasts. But the end of the thing we call rock and roll is much harder to pin down. When did the music as hot and vital cool to the point where only the background noise is evidence of its existence? Some say the day the music died wasn't long after the first iteration of the 1950s. Others have said 1964, 73, 1976. I've heard and read many compelling views. I don't think it was any of those dates. The rock and roll music was still vital and expanding, gaining new audiences, still influencing culture and vice versa. But by the mid-1990s, or certainly by the beginning of the 21st century, it did get cold to the point when contraction occurred. When it wasn't the cultural driver it once was, when the kids moved on to other things. To us, that last great movement of rock and roll was the 90s alt-rock, probably started with the grunge movement. It appears the music that came from that time is perhaps the last gasp of the art form that in the end will be a uniquely 20th century movement. And I mean as a creative force, expanding and building new horizons. It is now a thing of the past. Not that there isn't great music to be found out there, don't get me wrong. It's just not the cultural, relevant, and informative touchstone it once was. Today, we got to talk to one of the guys who helped birth that final iteration. Anyway, not to leave everyone on a bummer, but I did warn you, he was sick at the top of the show. Blame it on the drugs. Yes, legal ones. Legal ones. Oh, and the vitamins that are making me feel much better now. Hey, go out and pick up Tyson Mead's new album, Robbing the Nuclear Family, on March 22nd. And if he is on the road, go support him by seeing the show. Because maybe I'm wrong, and rock and roll isn't dead just yet. It just needed a swift kick in the pants again to get the blood moving and the muscles twitching, the lip curl raising back, and I don't give a fuck attitude to return. And let me know what you think. Okay, this is Christian Swain, and you've been listening to Deeper Digs in Rock, a Pantheon podcast. I will see you next week, and as always, keep up the rockin'.
Crazy little monkey, he got so ambitious, swinging through the jungle with his coward wishes. He sings fire, 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 fire.
Looking for ways to help right the wrongs of social injustice? Oxfam America works with people in more than 90 countries to save lives, develop long-term solutions to poverty, and campaign for social change. And we do it with the help of our friends in the music world. The Beatles were Oxfam supporters back in the day. So were the Stones. And through the years, musicians and music fans have helped Oxfam push hard to work for a just world without poverty. Folks like Radiohead, Coldplay, Pearl Jam, DJ Shadow, and many, many more have encouraged their fans to join the effort. You can too. Go to OxfamAmerica.org to learn how you can help.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.